Welcome back to the Bible Class Debrief. I'm here with Tim and Micah, and they just taught Lesson 3.1, God's Answer to the Fall, Flood, and Babel. The call and Abraham called and divided. And so we have the passages relevant here, Genesis 11:27 to 14:24. So it covers, covers three chapters or so, and... or four chapters, and goes through a good portion of Abraham's life and Abraham's call. Tim, you want to kick it off and tell us how you set this up for your class?
I said this was one of those lessons where I wanted to start at creation and walk into it. So I took a little time at the beginning to go back to God made the world for us and us for the world, and gave us the world to tend and to guard, and we broke it, and walked through the fall and the failures following the fall, culminating in the flood and the rebellion at Babel, into the world that Abram lives in which you have, this is a world it's a fairly, at this point, religiously, it seems a little bit of a diverse world. We have Melchizedek going to show up out of nowhere, king and priest to the actual God. We have Pharaoh, who's from history, presenting himself as the son of the sun god and a divine king. It's a world of divine kings who are pretending to be something that they're not, falling out of the Babel revolt. And there's no indication actually that Abram is not Noah. Abram is not the last faithful holdout. First of all, because he's not the last. And also because there's no indication actually that he's following God before God appears to him, and God mugs him and says, I'm going to do this thing for you. And we have some indication elsewhere in scripture that perhaps he's not. He's a idol worshiping Aramean who God just went, you know what? You're the one. We're doing this. And God makes him this promise out of the clear blue. So walked them into, this is the world in which Abram lives.
Mm.
And then launched into the Genesis 12 from there.
Right. Nice. How about you, Micah? Anything to add to that? Did you do a little setup for him?
Yeah. I mean, we just started with reviewing the three falls. We talked about Adam and Eve disobeying and how that sort of sets the tone for the world. And then, of course, Cain killing Abel and how that makes the world more messed up. And then Noah is God's response, the flood. And then the Tower of Babel and how that has created that world. And so that's the world Abraham is in when God calls him.
Nice. Now, I should let everyone know Micah's voice is a little creaky, so we're not going to force her to talk too much today, but do appreciate that she spoke up a little bit and would like to hear more. Did you, Micah, we did this command, divide, name, evaluate thing. Mm-hmm. Did you go through that and connect it back to creation for your students?
Yeah, I did. We talked about how we went back to creation a little bit and reviewed the whole command, divide, name, evaluate things. So we talked about, like, okay, so God makes light, like he commands it into existence, and then he divides it into day and night, and then he like names it and evaluates it. And then we went through Abraham's life and calling and compared it.
Nice. I like that you use light, because that's what God is creating with the family of Abraham, is the light to all the nations. Right. Tim, did you touch the command, divide, name, evaluate theme?
I really didn't this time. Although my plan is, as we set up moving up to Mount Moriah, to tag it in at that point.
Okay.
And use it as the rubric that we're going to go back and review under.
Uh-huh. Nice. All right. Well, walking then into Genesis 12, what did you pull out of that, Tim?
In 12, let's see, how far does 12 go? Okay. In 12, what I focused on was the Abraham's failure to trust God. He's got a promise that God is going to make him a great nation. He's got a leading to come down to Canaan. Mm-hmm. And then things are a little rough in Canaan, so he just keeps going. And goes down to Egypt. And then he's a little scared because his wife is beautiful. And I mean, the temptation, the fear is well-founded.
Right.
Right. He's sojourning in the territory of one of the divine kings. This is a, you know, Egypt is a big deal, and it's a place where if Pharaoh decides to kill him, like, he's dead, humanly speaking. And he's an attractive target.
Right.
You could kill him. He's pretty wealthy, so you could kill him, take all his stuff, and his wife's hot. So there you go. the fear is well-founded, humanly speaking.
Yeah.
And what he has, like, what I underscored with my kids is he's making the Eve mistake. He's looking, he's evaluating according to what he sees in the world, and he's forgetting what God said, not taking what God said to him into account in his decision-making process. And so I'm a really tempting target. My wife's very attractive. We're just going to solve this problem in this way and forgets God said, I'm going to make you a great nation. I mean, hard to do when you're dead. He's pretty safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was cool. Like one of my kids actually, I didn't even have to point that out. Like one of my kids pointed it out. They were like, wait a minute. Didn't God just promise him to make him a great nation? And he's afraid someone's going to kill him. Like, how does that work?
Nice.
I was like, yes.
Yeah, and I love that. You see that all over scripture is these juxtapositions without any comment. And I think there's just a side lesson to be learned about, you know, how to teach things is sometimes just telling a story and putting two things next to each other and let them figure out the problem. So that's really cool that they identified that before you told them. Okay, so we're through 12. We're coming back into the land. Abraham and Lot have returned in chapter 13. They're arguing over the land here. How did you? This seems like a sort of kind of moving off in a different direction now. But is it another one of those juxtapositions? Is there something to learn here? What do you got, Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a place where Abram acts in concert with what God has told him. Mm. He's stronger than Lot. He's senior to Lot. And they both got really, really wealthy in Egypt. And it makes a point of saying Pharaoh was really kind to Abram for Sarai's sake, gave him all this stuff. I can't imagine that Lot got nothing out of this deal.
Right.
It's like Abram's Pharaoh's favorite for some reason. And I'm his nephew. Hey, would you like to meet the big guy? I can make that happen for a small price. So Lot has, they both come out of Egypt with the kind of wealth that makes its own weather.
Yeah.
And now they have a new problem. The problem before was there's a famine in the land and Sarai is really attractive. And Abram did not do well with that problem. The problem now is that God has, despite Abram's failure, so blessed them that Abram and Lot get along and all their servants are fighting. And with good reason. Like, there's only so much grass. There's only so much water. If your job is to mind these 100 sheep and these clowns are getting in the way, like, you got a problem.
Yeah.
And so Abram offers, like, what has God promised Lot? Nothing, as far as we know.
Right.
So Abram takes Lot up the mountain and goes, Lot, I want you to look around. I want you to pick the best direction for you. I'll go anywhere because God's got me. Like, you tell me what you want. And I remember, like, this is a different way of approaching this than all the time I was growing up when we would teach this story. The Sunday school teachers would present it as Lot, that selfish skunk, took the good land and left Abraham with the desert. No, Abraham offers him the choice on purpose because he knows God's got him no matter where he goes.
Right.
And Lot also knows that God's made Abram this promise and hasn't promised him any such thing. So he's like, well, I'm going to take that. That looks good. That looks like it's a good decision for me and my family. I know God's got you. I'm going to go that way. And Abram is fine with it. He takes anywhere. And the irony in how God works with this is that the chapter ends with Abraham moves, dwells by the terebinth trees of Mamre, which, as it turns out, is where he makes his allies,
mm-hmm.
who are going to go help him whoop the kings in the next chapter.
Yeah.
So part of God's provision, God not only provides for his flocks and herds, God also uses this parting from Lot to set him up with his allies.
It's interesting here because where Abram does end up in the land of Canaan, whereas Lot is, I'm assuming he's east of the Jordan or south of the, you know, south of the Jordan, where Sodom and Gomorrah are probably about where Dead Sea is. And so that land must have been more fertile or looked more fertile than the actual promised land, the land of Canaan. And now, of course, that land, I think, is kind of the opposite.
Sort of bombed out.
Yeah. Right. Anything to add to that, Micah?
Yeah, no, that's like super interesting what you said about Abraham to trust God to have it. Yeah, I don't even think we really talk much about Lot and Abraham dividing the land. So I don't have much to add.
The chapter ends with there he built an altar to the Lord.
Mm.
That's one of these places where you see, significant. Whenever Abraham builds an altar or digs a well, there's something important that's going to happen there later on.
Yeah, and we did talk a little bit about that, just like the fact that there's not a temple or a tabernacle yet. So Abraham's a traveling priest and like to pay attention when he makes an altar, and we'll continue to see that.
And having just read The Conquest of Hebron by Caleb in church, like, this is noteworthy. Abram puts an altar here mm-hmm. in Hebron. Caleb goes and takes that later.
Yeah.
And it's a noteworthy thing. There's a bunch of space in Joshua devoted to the conquest of this place where Abram once built an altar.
Interesting. All right. So now we get to chapter 14, and we have this big story where Abram rescues Lot. Did you guys spend time? You still have time for this after you did everything else? Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I got a little carried away and got into chapter 15 in the covenant.
Oh, good.
And then realized as I'm rolling into Hagar, I was supposed to stop like a while ago. So we're going to have to do some looping back next week. We got into this. And it required a little bit of a setup because these tributary arrangements are different. Like, it's not something that makes a ton of sense. We don't really do this today in any obvious way. We do it all the time, actually. But it's not something a middle schooler is necessarily familiar with. But it was easy to explain. Empires are hard to govern.
Yeah.
it is much easier to say, listen, here's the deal. Come this fall, when all the crops come in, you're going to give me a bunch of stuff.
Hmm.
If you don't give me a bunch of stuff, you will be absolutely safe all winter long, I promise. But come the good weather, me and my buddies are coming down and we're going to beat you up and take everything you've got and maybe kill you all. You know, we'll see how it goes. What do you say? And like, this happens all the time.
Right.
And this is the kind of arrangement they have. And for 12 years, they keep the arrangement. And then in the 13th year, they just don't send the gravy train. They keep all the harvest for themselves. So come the 14th, all winter, nothing bad happens. Come the 14th year.
Yeah.
King Cheddar's coming for you.
King Cheddar.
The big cheese.
The big cheese. That's right. And I think the way we laid this up, laid this out in the curriculum was as a kind of foreshadowing of the later conquest of Canaan. How did that play? Did you guys build that out a little bit? Micah, looks like
yeah.
You.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that. We talked about how Abraham's conquest of this is kind of a picture of Joshua's conquest, which is also kind of a picture of, like, when you become a Christian, like, God gives you so, like, things to conquest.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about how there's layers there. We kind of mentioned it for a moment.
Nice.
We focused more on the way in which he's effectively given, in a certain way, he's given that land that he gave away to Lot.
Yeah.
Right? All of the wealth of that land, King Chedorlaomer comes down and takes. Abraham comes up, defeats the kings, takes it back, mm-hmm. and it's his. He doesn't keep it, as it turns out, but it's all his.
Mm-hmm.
And the king of Sodom is content to have it be his. Like, right. Let me have my people back, and you can do whatever you like. You can keep the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns it. It's one of the things. He has become great. He has become wealthy to the point that he has no trouble turning this down.
Yeah.
But also, he's like, this is, you know, he gets given back the wealth of the plains of Sodom come into his hands. And he goes, well, I'm going to give a tenth to Melchizedek.
Yeah.
And my allies can have their share.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll gift the rest back to Sodom as seed money to get them back on their feet again. It's fine.
Right.
God's blessed me. So he's continuing that theme of when he divides from Lot of God's got me and I'm not worried about it.
Yeah.
All the way through here, this whole episode. And it's another one of those juxtapositions. You have the king that comes down and assaults Abraham's family, and it doesn't go well for him. And we have a king that comes out and blesses Abraham.
Yep.
And in return, receives a tenth of the wealth of the plains of Sodom. So bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. Uh-huh. Like God is enacting that in Abraham's dealing with the kings around him.
Yeah. Nice. All right. So this lesson kind of ends up with the story of Melchizedek, which is obviously a well-known little story that's referred back to in Hebrews and made reference to in, what is it, Psalm 110? And lot to look forward to through this one. Did you guys start cashing out any of that, or just mention it and cash it out later? What'd you do with it?
Well, we talked a little bit about how Melchizedek gives him bread and wine, which is interesting. Uh-huh. And I never even noticed that until you guys pointed it out in your book. I was like, that's so cool. And So that kind of got on a tangent a little bit about communion. And this one kid was like, she didn't even know, like, she'd never even heard of, you know, different theories on Melchizedek, but she's like, he's kind of like Jesus. Sorry, my throat is not working. And I'm like, yeah, there are debates about that. She's like, wait, really? That was kind of funny.
Nice.
So we talked a little bit about that and the fact that he also worships Yahweh. And how that must have been encouraging. So anyway, I apologize. I cannot talk right now. But
no. Nice.
We cashed it out because of the setup that I used in Abram's world. This is one of the things that it gives us is that Babel's not a universal revolt. It's simply not the case that there's no one anywhere who knows the true God anymore.
Right.
In Abram's world, you have lots of people who don't. But even the people who don't recognize that Yahweh is kind of special and Abram's relationship with Yahweh is kind of special. And you see that throughout Abram's dealings with people. And you also have people like Melchizedek out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
With no particular discussion of, you know, who he is or, you know, how he relates. Like, up to now, you have genealogy on everybody who matters in the story.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody, literally nobody, who really is somebody we should pay attention to, who... I mean, you have walk-on characters like the King of Sodom, but even for him, we can go back to the Table of Nations and sort of figure out who,
right.
You know, how he connects, right? And Melchizedek, all of a sudden, we got nothing. Here's this Yahweh worshiper in the middle of, like, what will one day be Jerusalem.
Yeah.
In the middle of the land that God has given Abraham. And he doesn't connect anywhere. Abraham didn't, like... evangelize him as he was passing through the first time or like none of that we know of. He's just there.
Yeah.
Which raises a question of how many other, like when you go and dig into like the mythology of the world, you will find places where the story is told more faithfully than other places.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's variable. It's not universally rebellious, which is a really interesting thing. You have it's not universally rebellious. There are people who still follow Yahweh in Abram's world, and here's this guy. And so they're both following Yahweh. So he comes out and blesses him and receives a blessing, you know, receives a tithe in return. Didn't really cash out the Christ thing yet. Kind of saving that one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. All right. That brings us to the end of 3.1. So we will... see you all next time on Bible Class Debrief. Thanks, Tim and Micah.